From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Twenty-five years ago today, militant Iranian students stormed the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and took 66 Americans hostage. 52 of them weren't freed until 15 months later. It was the defining event of Jimmy Carter's presidency and had lasting implications for U.S. relations with Islamic countries. On today's Fresh Air, we look back on the Iranian hostage crisis with journalist Mark Bowden. He's best known as the author of Black Hawk Down. His new article in The Atlantic is based on his interviews with the hostage takers. Also, we talk with Phil Jackson. His new memoir is about his final season coaching the Los Angeles Lakers, dealing with conflicts between superstars Kobe Bryant and Shaquille O'Neal, and keeping the team focused while Bryant faced sexual assault charges. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush held a news conference today in which he announced plans to move quickly on initiatives he said the American people have made clear they want, NPR's David Wellner reports.
Having won 51% of the popular vote, President Bush outlined an ambitious agenda, most of which will require the support of a new Congress with bigger Republican majorities in both chambers. The president made clear he wants to act while a political honeymoon lasts and before being perceived as a lame duck.
I've earned capital in this election, and I'm going to spend it for what I've told the people I'd spend it on, which is, you've heard the agenda, Social Security and tax reform, moving this economy forward, education, fighting and winning the war on terror.
Asked what he plans to do about huge federal deficits, the president said he wants Congress to curtail spending, as well as spur economic expansion to generate more tax revenues. He said he would not be raising taxes. Mr. Bush did not say how much more the war in Iraq will be costing American taxpayers. David Wellner, NPR News, Washington.
Aides to Yasser Arafat say the Palestinian leader has slipped into a coma at a military hospital near Paris. There have been conflicting reports about the 75-year-old leader's condition, including rumors that he was dead. Doctors at the French military hospital said those reports were not true, but Arafat's aides say he is in serious condition. Palestinian officials transferred some of Arafat's financial powers to Prime Minister Ahmed Correa so that government operations could continue. International observers who came to the United States to monitor Tuesday's election said that voting generally went smoothly, but they expressed concerns about long lines and confusion over the rules. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe was invited to monitor the elections by the U.S. State Department. Barbara Herring of Switzerland led the observation team.
It appears that the voting and the processing of ballots generally were carried out in an orderly manner. However, significant delays at polling stations are likely to deter voters from voting and thus may even restrict the right to vote.
She said steps should be taken to reduce the amount of time voters must wait to cast their ballots. The observers also said that the rules about when and how to use provisional ballots should be clarified. They noted that the procedures varied from state to state and sometimes from polling place to polling place. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
Afghan President Hamid Karzai made a victory speech today pledging to crack down on Afghanistan's regional warlords and fight the growing drug trade. His election was confirmed yesterday. In stocks, the Dow gained 177 to close at 10,314. The Nasdaq was up 19 to 2023. This is NPR News. Iraqi rebels killed three British soldiers and wounded eight others today in a suicide bomb and mortar attack in central Iraq. The soldiers were members of the mostly Scottish Black Watch Regiment, which was recently ordered to the area to free up American troops for action against rebel-held cities. The plan to move the British troops was approved by British Prime Minister Tony Blair, despite opposition in Parliament that included some members of his own party. The deaths bring the total death toll for British troops in Iraq to 73. Worker productivity in the third quarter rose at its slowest pace since the fourth quarter of 2002. The government says there was a 1.9% increase for the July through September quarter. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
The gain in worker productivity, a measure of output per hour worked, was about half the rate of the previous 3 months. The slowdown in productivity showed that companies may be running out of ways to get more out of their existing workforce, something economists say could boost hiring in the months ahead. The slower productivity growth was accompanied by a 1.6% rise in labor costs. However, that is still relatively reined in. Employment has been a weak spot for the economy in recent months. The government tomorrow releases its employment figures for October. Most analysts expect the economy to have added substantially more jobs than the 96,000 it added in September. The unemployment rate is expected to hold steady at 5.4%. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
U.S. forces continued air and artillery attacks today against suspected rebel positions in the Iraqi city of Fallujah. The U.S. military is preparing for a possible offensive against Fallujah. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 25 years ago today, radical Islamic students stormed the American embassy in Tehran, taking the diplomatic team hostage. The students held 52 hostages for 444 days. Today, several thousand Iranians celebrated the anniversary by burning American flags and chanting "Death to America." My guest Mark Bowden has written an article for the December issue of The Atlantic magazine about the Iranian students who took the hostages. He's writing a book about the Iranian hostage crisis. He found that some of the hostage takers are now in the government, while others regret their actions. Bowden is also the author of Black Hawk Down and has a new book collecting his articles called Roadwork. In 1979, a grassroots revolution in Iran overthrew the Shah's dictatorship. The Ayatollah Khomeini had returned to Iran from exile, and a new revolutionary council set up a provisional government. After the U.S. allowed the Shah to come here for cancer treatment, a group of revolutionaries took over the U.S. embassy in Tehran. I asked Mark Bowden to describe the reaction in the U.S. to these events.
Well, there was At first, of course, a big burst of media attention. I know a lot of television and newspaper reporting. It was an outrage. You know, the United States Embassy had been overrun by what appeared to be a just sort of ragtag bunch of Iranian students who had taken hostage all of the American diplomats and the Marines and the staff of the embassy. And I think there's an instinctive feeling that most Americans have that we should do something. We should go in there and chase those people out and get our people back. But, of course, on a practical level, it was a very difficult situation for the administration. Iran was a country that was extremely hostile to the United States. We had no military presence anywhere nearby. We really weren't in a position to do much. And then to make it doubly more difficult, there was no... Very quickly after the embassy was seized, the provisional government there folded. So there was no one to even negotiate with. So I think Americans were angry, confused, frustrated by what happened.
And kind of afraid because suddenly we were the great Satan. I don't think we've grown used to that.
But, right.
I mean, at the time it was kind of, it was incredibly shocking to see Americans paraded around with blindfolds and being held hostage.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about how this was the beginning of what has become a conflict between parts of the West, like the United States, and the more extremist end of militant Islam.
Well, it is, and it was. I remember being particularly shocked by it because it was one of those events that changed my understanding of America and its role in the world. I mean, I grew up during the Cold War when, you know, the United States and the Soviet Union formed these two great blocks, and so, you know, we would expect that the Americans would encounter hostility in a Soviet bloc country. But this was now a country that was not in the Soviet bloc, was not a communist country. And there erupted this sort of vehement hatred of the United States, which was shocking to me and something that I just didn't understand. I don't think most Americans understood it. And I didn't know enough about Iran or its history to know where it was coming from. But the idea that there were these people who, for religious and historic and cultural reasons, just thought of the United States as the source of all evil.
Well, in the past few years, you've made several trips to Iran, and you write that going to Iran now is like visiting Bizarro World, a mirror universe in which everything is inverted. What are some examples of that in the current Iran?
Well, I think that the most obvious example are the images all over the city of Tehran. You see American symbols everywhere, but always in sort of debased and in propaganda displays where, you know, the American flag is in the shape of a pistol or the American eagle is shown crashing in flames. So that's the first and most obvious way. I went over there, the last time I was in Tehran was in August during the Olympics. And here in the United States, you know, as I was leaving, the television here in the United States is portraying sort of one glorious triumph after another of American athletes in the Olympics. And I got to Tehran, and there, you know, they were portraying one American defeat and humiliation after another. It's all a matter of emphasis. And so in those instances where an American would win a gold medal, it would be portrayed as a rare moment when, you know, the United States manages to sort of stave off humiliation. And you know, things like that start to make you feel like you've entered into a warp where everything is backwards.
What does the embassy compound that the hostages were held in look like now?
Well, it's right in the heart of Tehran. It's a 27-acre compound, and it really is striking. It's a kind of oasis because the city is just a teeming sprawl of 12 million people, very busy, congested, loud, noisy, dirty. And this is basically a 27-acre compound with a pine grove. And what it looks like today is pretty much what it looked like 25 years ago. The main building, the Chancery Building, is they used to call it Henderson High. It looks like one of these high schools that was built in the 1940s. It's kind of orange brick, two stories tall, about a block long, a handsome building. But it has been decorated with anti-American propaganda. So on the brick wall all around the outside of the embassy are murals showing things like the Statue of Liberty with a death mask, or, you know, again, you know, the American eagle going down in flames, or slogans, death to the United States, or quotes from Khomeini, we shall inflict a great evil, or we shall inflict a great defeat on the great Satan. So it's kind of festooned with this anti-American propaganda.
What functions are these buildings and the former embassy compound used for?
Well, the Chancery itself is home to a permanent exhibition of anti-American propaganda, which is which I went through, and is frankly pretty unimpressive. I think I could probably do a better job of putting together an anti-American display.
What's in it?
Well, there are these sort of papier-mâché models of the Statue of Liberty with fangs, and, you know, photographs of poor maimed children who are the victims of, you know, bombings or whatever, you know, big cartoonish, like, paintings on the walls of Uncle Sam strangling babies, and it's just awful. It looks like, I described it in the story, I think, as something that a bunch of high school students with a bad attitude would put together. But that's the main building, and the compound itself is used as a base for the Revolutionary Guards, who are the elite military unit that protects the regime. The other half of the compound is a headquarters for the Bajlis, which is a civilian organization, which I compare to the sort of fascist brown shirts, who are called out to with sticks and just in by, you know, numbers, I guess, to put down any kind of anti-regime protests that go on, and also are used to enforce the regime's rules and regulations about the way women are allowed to dress. People are prohibited from holding hands, men and women, women and women, and nobody can hold hands, I guess, except for maybe mothers and daughters can hold hands. But, you know, these are the people who are fanatics, civilian fanatics, who enforce the regime's rules and regulations.
You were able to actually interview some of the people who took the Americans hostage 25 years ago. Were they all willing to talk with you?
No, not all of them. Some, I would say even most of them, weren't willing to talk to me. It's still a very volatile political situation in Iran, and involvement in the takeover of the embassy puts you in a peculiar position because it's one of the sort of founding acts of this of the revolution. And if you're opposed to it, which some of the former hostage takers are, then to speak out honestly about it, you run the risk of being arrested and beaten or put in jail. A lot of the people who were involved would prefer not to talk about it at all, just to avoid being put in that position. Some of the people who took over the embassy remain very religious, highly connected with the regime, very anti-American. So they would just view me as probably a CIA agent or a, you know, a military intelligence person, not a reporter, and they wouldn't trust me enough to sit and talk to me. So the people who would talk to me are those who, not all of them, but most of the ones I spoke with are the ones who have sort of put their neck out by publicly criticizing what happened.
You spoke to the student who actually came up with the idea of taking Americans hostage in the Iranian embassy, in the American embassy in Iran. Tell us something about who this person was then and what they're doing now.
Well, Ibrahim Esgarzadeh was a engineering student at Tehran University in 1979. And he had always been, I think, he said he'd always been fairly political. And, of course, Iran, in the year prior to the takeover of the American embassy, had been through this wrenching revolution where the people had risen up and overthrown the regime of the Shah, chased the Shah basically out of Iran, and were in the process of sort of trying to create a new government. So a lot of young people, like Ibrahim Esgarzadeh, had sort of drifted away from their study and their planned career path and gotten caught up in the revolution. He was had become a sort of political leader on campus at Tehran University, and he and four other students met in as part of this small political organization that Esgarzadeh had formed, and were discussing ways of demonstrating or what they should do next. And they actually had a vote over whether to attack the American embassy or the Soviet embassy. And they voted, and three of the this original group agreed that they wanted to go after the American embassy, and that's what really started it. So that's who Esgarzadeh was then. Today, he's well known for having been the instigator of the takeover of the embassy. He is a reform politician who has spent some time in jail for criticisms of the regime, and he's a newspaper editor whose newspaper, amazingly, is still being published in Iran at a time when most reform newspapers have been shut down.
Now, one proposal was to target the Soviet embassy instead of the American embassy. Because why?
Well, because the Soviets represented a godless power that was a threat to Iran. The Soviet Union bordered on Iran. The foundation of the Iranian Revolution was extreme Islam, religious fervor. And so some of the Iranian students who were not Marxist-leaning, who were more nationalist, viewed the Soviet Union as the greatest threat to their new country. Most of them, three of the five, viewed, you know, the United States as really being the biggest threat to Iran. And that goes back to a rather dark episode in our history where, you know, we interfered with the politics in Iran. And I think, you know, we deserve some of the antipathy that we have.
This is 1953 that you're referring to, when the CIA helped to overthrow Mossadegh, who was the democratically elected president of Iran.
Right. And installed the Shah, you know, which led to the next 20 years of Iranian history. So there was a great deal of honest resentment of the United States in Iran, and a growing fear that the United States was going to interfere with this new revolution.
My guest is Mark Bowden, the author of Black Hawk Down. His article in the December edition of The Atlantic magazine is about the students behind the Iranian hostage crisis. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Bowden, and he has an article called Among the Hostage Takers in the December issue of the Atlantic Monthly, and it's about the men and women who took hostage Americans in the Iranian embassy 25 years ago, and he's currently working on a book called Guest of the Ayatollah about what happened 25 years ago in Iran. Well, you quote the student who instigated the hostage taking as saying, "Our aim was to object to the American government by going to their embassy and occupying it for several hours." Right. Well, it was 444 days, not several hours. What did you learn about what the original plan was and what they really expected to happen?
Well, the students were very naive, as students tend to be, and they saw this as just a demonstration right out of the mold of demonstrations that they had seen in Europe and in the United States during the Vietnam War era, where college students would take over the dean's office and hold it for, a week or two as a way of publicizing their grievances and whatever. This is what these students had in mind. But behind the students was a fairly sophisticated organization of mullahs led by a cleric named Koeniha, who was popular among the students. And I think, if you want to talk about what the motives were, you have to differentiate the motives of someone like Koeniha from those of the students. Koeniha is in the middle of a power struggle in Iran. What had happened was, after the Shah left, there was a real wrestling match going on inside of Iran between those Iranian politicians who wanted to create a secular democratic state, a more traditional government. And then there were the mullahs and the religious extremists who wanted something completely different than that. They wanted to try to create this new holy Islamic republic. But in their way, in the mullahs' way, was the provisional government that the Ayatollah Khomeini had established when he came back to Iran. Now, I think that Koeniha, who was sort of the guiding force behind the students, he was less interested in having a demonstration and announcing to the world their grievances. He saw an opportunity to rally public support behind anti-Americanism, to focus all of the anger toward the United States and bring it to bear on this political struggle that was taking place in Tehran. And in fact, what happened was that the takeover of the embassy created an outpouring of anti-American demonstrations throughout Iran and put such pressure on the provisional government, which was obligated to protect the Americans who were part of that diplomatic mission, that they resigned the day after the embassy was taken. So now suddenly these students who walk into the embassy thinking that they're going to be there for a day or two and do their demonstration are in the middle of a raging political storm in their own country. The Ayatollah Khomeini announces that he supports what they've done, elevating them to the status of national heroes. It was a piece of political theater that tipped the scales in the power struggle toward the mullahs. And so the students found themselves, I think, trapped in much the same way that the Americans who were working at the embassy found themselves trapped. And there was no way for them to walk out after all this happened.
Were there any Iranian students who participated in the hostage taking who felt that their efforts were co-opted by the mullahs? In other words, that the students were being used by the mullahs?
Many of them feel that way today. In fact, many of them felt that way at the time. There were a large number of those who were involved in the initial takeover of the embassy who just left and who refused to stay involved because what was going on is something that violated their own principles. So that what you had left after the first week were the hardcore of those who were willing to play along with this power play in Tehran, and then all the others who they recruited who came from the more fanatical reach of, in the Islamic students' organizations, who came in to be guards and to actually make the captivity work.
You write about how the leader of this student group who initiated the idea of the hostage-taking at the American embassy met and proposed to his wife during the hostage crisis.
Right.
What are some of the things you learned about the atmosphere inside the embassy for the students who were the hostage takers?
Well, I think that's actually, Terry, one of the most interesting things about this story. And, we view things, through an American lens. But if you can imagine being in a country that has lived under the sort of totalitarian heel of someone like the Shah for your entire life, and then have to have been part of a, an uprising, a national revolution that overthrows this terrible dictator. And here you have, at age 18, 19, 20, an opportunity to take part in creating a new kind of country. So everyone, you know, called themselves brother and sister, and there was this wonderful, almost euphoric feeling of possibility at the time. And so, you know, love blossoms in such atmospheres. And so you had, you know, inside the embassy a number of men, young men and women, you know, living and working together side by side, month after month after month. And so it's not terribly surprising that romances ensued. And a number of the hostages I met and interviewed met and married, you know, during this whole episode.
The hostage takers?
Yes.
Yeah. Were the hostage takers able to leave the compound at all, or were they as stuck there as the hostages?
No, the hostage takers did leave. They worked in shifts, so they would have just basically a regular work day. Clearly, though, for the leaders, you know, this became a full-time occupation, and many of them, you know, told me that in retrospect how frustrated they were to have suddenly been yanked out of their schooling and their career path and their personal lives, and to have suddenly been saddled with this tremendous responsibility. But at the same time, it made them very important people. I mean, if you can imagine, you know, you're a bunch of college students and you decide to make a demonstration, and suddenly you are a player on an international stage and, you know, helping to make policy for your country and dealing, you know, in very, very high stakes, the center of a whole lot of press attention, and regarded as a national hero in your country. So I think there was a mix of sort of pride of having been able to accomplish something, as they saw it, you know, terribly important, and also some sense of frustration that it dragged on and on and on and kept them from maybe what they personally would have preferred to have been doing.
Mark Bowden's article, Among the Hostage Takers, is in the December edition of The Atlantic magazine. A new collection of his articles has just been published called Roadwork. Bowden will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Mark Summers' newly illustrated edition of Poems and Tales by Edgar Allan Poe, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, and from TIAA Craft, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good, TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with Phil Jackson about his final season coaching the Los Angeles Lakers, while superstar Kobe Bryant faced sexual assault charges. Also, more on the Iranian hostage crisis with journalist Mark Bowden. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mark Bowden. He's best known as the author of Black Hawk Down. We're talking about his article in the December edition of The Atlantic magazine about the Iranian hostage crisis. It began 25 years ago when militant Iranian students took over the American embassy in Tehran, taking the Americans hostage. The article is based on Bowden's interviews with the hostage takers. Bowden is writing a book about the crisis. What are some of the positions of power that the former hostage takers have risen to in Iran?
Well, the two most powerful are a couple who actually met during the hostage taking and married. One is Mohammad Hashemi, who became the deputy secretary of the intelligence ministry, which is a very nefarious, sinister, and powerful organization in Iran. It's like the secret police in Iran. And he was one of the most powerful figures in the regime for many years, just recently stepped away from that and has gone into private business. He's married to Masumeh Ebtekar, who is now a vice president of Iran in charge of the environment, who was the most famous to Americans of the hostage takers because she was raised partly in Philadelphia as a child and spoke fluent American-accented English. And so she became, in the press conferences and things that the students held during this crisis, the spokesman for them. And so Americans would see this sort of chubby-faced young Iranian woman who spoke absolutely perfect American English, you know, denouncing the United States on TV. And it made her, I think, the most notorious and the most hated of the hostage takers.
And who are some of the students who feel alienated or betrayed by the current Iranian government and feel that the revolution was hijacked, that it wasn't the idealistic vision that they had when they participated in the revolution 25 years ago?
Well, Ibrahim Asgharzadeh is one. Abbas Abdi was one of the central figures who's now serving a prison sentence because he was a newspaper editor and he published a poll, the results of a poll, which showed that 74% of Iranians wanted renewed ties with the United States, which so angered the regime that they threw him in jail. Abdi has made efforts to reach out to former hostages and to try to begin to repair some of the damage between the United States and Iran, for which he's, you know, serving a prison sentence. Mohsen Mirdamadi was a member of the Majlis, a very high-ranking member of the Majlis, who was one of the founders of the students who took over the embassy. I was scheduled to interview Mirdamadi last December in Tehran. I was in Tehran planning to see him the next day. He was attacked and beaten by one of these groups of, you know, Iranian brown shirts as he was giving a speech at a local university, and we ended up being in the hospital, and I never got a chance to meet him. But he's spoken out very bitterly about the way that the revolution has turned out in Iran, saying that he felt that when they got rid of the Shah, that they had rid their country of totalitarianism, and now all they've done is create a new kind of totalitarian state.
Now, a lot of people think that the future of Iran lies with the current students, and that the current students want freedom, or at least more freedom than they have, and they don't want to live in a religious theocracy. Did you speak to any young people who are students now in Iran and ask them about their perceptions of the students who took the Americans hostage 25 years ago?
Yes, I spoke to a lot. And most of the people who I met and talked to are embarrassed by what happened in 1979. These are young Iranians. They despise the religious regime that runs their country. They chafe under the regulations that govern their lives, what they can wear, where they can go, what they can say. They're frightened of the regime. There were demonstrations, widespread student demonstrations a year ago in Iran that were violently cracked down on. And a number of the key student leaders from campuses have been sent to jail. This has intimidated young people to a great extent in Iran. So, you know, those who are opposed to the existing regime see the takeover of the American embassy as a founding example of the sort of pariah status that their country has that they would like to end. But by the same token, there are also still, you know, religious extremists, young people as well, who are totally on board with the ideology of the regime and with the notion that the United States represents everything evil in the world, and who would, I think, gladly sacrifice their lives in attacking the United States if they had the opportunity.
Hess, writing this book, and I know you're not finished with it yet, so you're not done with the process of thinking things through, but is the process of writing this book changing in any fundamental way your thoughts about what happened during the Iranian hostage crisis, or what the meaning of that crisis has finally been?
Well, it's changed my thinking about it in a lot of ways. I mean, I think I felt, as most Americans did, that this was a sort of unprovoked, illogical attack on the part of these sort of crazed, you know, Islamic students in Iran. And in fact, you know, when you begin to study the history of Iran, the role of the United States in Iran, you can see how logically very sensible, idealistic people could have become enraged at the United States and could have become so suspicious of the United States and its role in the country. So I have a much better understanding of how and why it happened from an Iranian perspective. I also think have a much better understanding of how much it was political theater. That the taking of the embassy was turned into, it's an act of political theater based upon myths that Iranians fervently believed about the United States, in the same way that that Americans have myths about people in other countries. And so, you know, there was a profound level of misunderstanding that's always there between two countries that don't know each other well. And then there were, I think, very clever people who manipulated these myths to accomplish their local political ends in Iran. So I think I see the takeover of the American embassy as a much more pivotal event in the history of Iran than anything else, that it's something that basically created the Iran that we face today.
What are the myths that you're talking about?
Well, the myths at the time were that the United States had this incredible intelligence capability and presence in Iran, that everything that happened that was a problem for the provisional government or for the, you know, Revolutionary Council was engineered by Americans. Whether it was, you know, rebel uprisings in Kurdistan or resistance that they faced up near the Soviet border, they even blamed hurricanes and train derailments, you know, the kind of natural disasters or accidents that happen in any country. Everything was blamed on the United States. And there was also this idea that the United States had this, you know, capability of doing just about whatever it wanted in Iran, when the truth was, as I've discovered by working on the story, is that the entire CIA presence in Iran in 1979 consisted of three CIA officers, all of whom were taken hostage in the takeover of the embassy. Tom Ahern, who had been there, who was the CIA station chief, had been there for only about 8 months. Bill Daugherty, the other CIA officer, had been only recruited to become a CIA agent the previous January and had been in Tehran for about 4 weeks. And Malcolm Kalp, who was the other CIA officer, who was there for 4 days before the embassy was taken. None of those three men even spoke Farsi. They had no contacts with anybody in the government. They had no capability of influencing anything going on in Iran. But the myth of this American omnipresence and omnipotence was so powerful in Iran that those who wanted to could stir up fears that the United States was planning to overthrow the revolution, was planning to bring the Shah back and put him back on the throne, all of which was just completely out of the question, something that the United States could not have done even if it had fervently wanted to do so.
Mark Bowden, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome, Terry.
Mark Bowden's article, Among the Hostage Takers, is in the December edition of The Atlantic. A new collection of his articles has just been published called Roadwork. Coming up, the great NBA coach Phil Jackson talks about his final season. This is Fresh Air. In his final season coaching the Los Angeles Lakers, Phil Jackson had to deal with conflicts between superstars Kobe Bryant and Shaquille O'Neal, who's now with the Miami Heat. And Jackson had to keep the team focused as Bryant faced sexual assault charges, which put him in the middle of a media circus. Now Jackson has written a memoir called The Last Season, A Team in Search of Its Soul. Jackson holds the NBA coaching record for most playoff wins. He won 6 NBA championships with the Chicago Bulls when it included Michael Jordan, Dennis Rodman, and Scottie Pippen. Jackson won 3 championships with the Lakers. In his last season, the Lakers lost to the Detroit Pistons in the finals. I spoke with him about his new memoir. You talk, of course, about the rape charges against Kobe Bryant, and you say, was I surprised? Yes, but not entirely. Why not?
Well, I think that, you know, having been around Kobe and seen, you know, his willpower, his, his commitment to doing what he wants to do when he wants to do it, his ability to be forceful and angry, has shown some of the characteristics that could have, you know, behaved in that pattern. But, you know, no one knows what's behind closed doors. And, you know, I refuse to speculate in that area at all.
How have you seen his anger manifested on the basketball court?
Well, in a variety of ways. Some of it at his teammates and some of it at himself and his opponents and some at referees. Some of it at me. In fact, that was probably one of the things that really changed our relationship in the last year. Prior to this, was that there were some heated words, vitriolic words, as I actually said to Kobe, that we can't have that. It's too destructive to have that vitriolic kind of hot flow coming out of you towards me, because it undermines what the team has to do. And we reached an impasse. We reached an impasse at some point, and were able to overcome that during the course of the year. And that basically is really the story of this book, is that maybe it was my approach, maybe it was my reticence to jump in with both feet, to leave Kobe alone and allow him to have all this space around a trial, a very trying time, accusations that were damning, a possible, sentence that would be, prohibitive to even playing basketball, perhaps, let alone destroying his life. Were things that, I wanted to stay apart from and back away from. And in reality, I think the book shows that the more involved I was with Kobe, the better off our relationship was. And rather than standing back and allowing him to have all this space, I needed to be involved and proactive and take advantage of the fact that, he was searching perhaps for a discipline, and he was searching perhaps for a leadership from me.
Are you surprised that he didn't sit the season out?
It was a consideration. And it was a consideration not only that we expressed to him and asked him about it in a meeting in August with him a year ago last August, but also something that we talked about between the general manager and myself, that, is it, going to be necessary for him to sit out? And at some point during the season, it was even suggested by me that maybe it was better if Kobe sat out for a while. And because his presence on the team was distraction, and I felt that it was a conflict for me to have to coach, especially when he wasn't capable of playing and he was injured, a dozen games or so in last season's, during the course of the last season.
You talk in your book about how you were concerned about how Kobe Bryant would mature coming of age in the NBA, which he joined when he was still in high school. What were some of your concerns?
When I began coaching the Lakers in 1999-2000 season, I believe Kobe just had turned 21, and I saw a young man who was living with his parents, even though he had moved into a separate house, and they kind of had spaces right next door to each other. They had kind of a compound in a Brentwood area of Los Angeles. And he had yet to have a relationship with a girl that was known about. His coming and goings were really monitored a lot by his parents, who had tried to, you know, monitor his development involvement in the NBA. His father had been an NBA player, known as Jelly Bean Bryant, and played with Philadelphia 76ers during the early 70s, and eventually went on to Italy to play for most of his career in the Italian leagues over there. But they knew what the NBA lifestyle was like. They knew the pitfalls of it, and they did want to make sure that Kobe's life was monitored and, you know, eased, and he had a way to get into the NBA without the shock of just dropping him in there. And so they had moved as a family out to L.A. So what I saw was a young man who was going to go through all the rebellion that you normally go through when your child goes off to college. He goes off to college. He learns how to take care of himself. He learns how to wash his clothes, feed himself, and doesn't call, perhaps doesn't answer the phone, has a rebellion attitude that is a way that children break away from their parents. And as they break away from their parents and they get involved in relationships with people of the opposite sex, they start to break away even farther philosophically. And because of Kobe's sheltered past, I saw that this was a young man that more than likely was going to have to go through all those growth processes during a course of playing basketball while he was involved very tightly in his family life, and have to make the movement towards maturation under a microscope. He wasn't going to be given that opportunity to do it in college where, you know, if you even have a college season where you're a high-profile college athlete, it might only be for 3.5 months on a college campus. It's not for an 8-month or 9-month period of time, which might involve an MBA year. So the spotlight was on his growth and development, and I knew that rebellion might even hold rebellion against the coach, who was an authority figure behind all that.
And that would be you.
That would be me.
You think he rebelled against you?
I think so. And, you know, I don't want to make any inference that I, you know, was a father figure to him, but there was a relationship that we had that was a real strong relationship at the start. And you know, he had to find his own way and had to, you know, step out on his own. And, you know, I think that my coaching influence over Kobe Bryant lasted only maybe 2.5 years of the 5 years that I was here with the Lakers in L.A.
My guest is Phil Jackson, former coach of the Chicago Bulls and the Los Angeles Lakers. His new memoir is about his final season with the Lakers. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Phil Jackson, and he has a new memoir about his last season with the Lakers, and it's called The Last Season. Now, the two superstars of this team during your last season were Kobe Bryant and Shaquille O'Neal. I mean, they were the superstars of the team through your tenure at yes. The Lakers. Do you think their relationship changed in any fundamental way during your final season, which was also Shaquille O'Neal's final season with the team?
I don't think it changed that much, Terry. I think it was pretty much set. They'd reached a certain impasse, and it was just brought back into reality at the beginning of the season before the first game. The conflict that happened between the two of them in the paper solidified, okay, this is how it's going to be. We're not going to ever find a real common ground to live from, but we can coexist together. Just don't disrespect me was kind of the message that Shaq had led, you know, Kobe to know And Kobe was, don't tell me how to play my game. I'm my own person. I'm not your sidekick. And that was the message I think the two of them wanted to get across to each other. And other than that, I felt that they were dedicated to winning a championship. And they were going to find a way to get to this position, regardless of how much angst and how much difficulty this team was going to provide to them.
What did you try to do to straighten out their relationship?
Well, there's all kinds of ways. And, you know, from actually running two-man games on the court with them to, you know, conferencing them together. But, you know, I think the reality was that I didn't use professional help, and I probably should have used conflict resolution or had some professional help come in that could be trusted, would feel appropriate support for both of them, not have a valence of plus or minus with either one of these two players so they didn't feel the other person was being favored, and had them really work on a relationship that made some sense to them, that these are the things that are evident. Kobe, you're never going to make the same amount of money that Shaq is. Shaq, you're never going to be able to bring the ball down the court and do whatever you want to do with it. You're going to have to rely on Kobe bringing the ball down the court. You guys are going to have to find a way to play together to make this thing work out to the best of our ability and support each other in these situations, because that's what a team's all about.
At what point did you decide? You say in your book at some point you decided that you couldn't stay on the team if Kobe Bryant stayed. What was like the tipping point for you on that?
You know, there are a number of incidents that preceded for about, 6 weeks or so. And you know, I try not to get into them all, but as we went along, there was just one that eventually, caught me off guard, and it was simply, the fact that he didn't come on the court and participate in the practice when he had said he was going to, and Kobe'd had an injury, a shoulder injury, and he didn't have to come on the court to participate in practice. He had to be out in the court to watch or observe. But I asked him if he's going to come out, and he said, yeah, sure. And then when he didn't participate, I asked him why, and he said, in very coarse language, because of my blank shoulder. And I said, I didn't know it hurt you that bad. And he said, well, you didn't ask. And then it led from one thing to another, where finally I just said, I'd like you just to be straight with me. And square up. And, as I turned to leave the room, I heard, some profanity behind me. And, that was, I just kept going and went to the general manager's office and said, I don't think I can reach this young man anymore. And I don't think it's, I'm the right person to continue on in this job. So if you're going to keep Kobe Bryant on this team, then I don't think we need to continue our contract negotiations. And you can tell the owner that, and walked out of the room. And, it's kind of described in the book as a tirade, but I don't think it reached tirade proportions. But it was firm, and I was angry.
This is a pretty personal book, not only, it contains a lot of reflections about other people and reflections about your conflicts with other people on the mm-hmm. team, but particularly Kobe Bryant. And I just wonder how you feel about making some of those conflicts more public than you'd made them before.
Well, it was something that obviously, I had to just sit on a long time this summer and think about, be reassured that, even though that it was personal, it's not about that. It's about the story. And it's got to be about the bigger picture that's in that story. It's not about the conflicts that happen. It's about the resolution that happens. It's about the fact that even in a resolution that happens, there wasn't enough fertile ground or enough foundation for us to have total success. And it's a near miss. And that in itself is intriguing in its own right. So the story itself stands out, even though it's personal and even though there are names used. It's about the acts as people. It's not about the people themselves.
Do you know how Kobe Bryant has reacted to your book?
Yes, he said And very, very, very rightly way, so that, you know, this is about a book in which Phil's trying to sell books. This is something, and he's stated some things that it's about selling books because it's controversial. And, you know, that's, Kobe's really good with the press. And, I think he's reacted, and his statement was simply this: I really respect the time I spent with Phil Jackson and our chance to team together and win some championships. And that's the professional, you know, side of Kobe Bryant that always steps forward.
Are you worried what he'll say about you when he writes his memoir?
Not really. I think that, it'll be even-handed because I've been honest and heartfelt with him.
So do you want to get back into basketball again in some capacity or another?
I don't know, Terry. I think the year will really answer that question.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to remain open to it without trying to be, like remorseful or, indebted to basketball. I want to remove myself from it so I have a chance to really, assess, do I want to be part of this? Is it fruitful? Is it, consistently a good way to, spend my time? And, when you're almost 60 years old, you don't have a whole lot of time left, and that's important.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and I wish you good travels.
Thank you very much, Terry. It's always a pleasure to be on your show. You have a wonderful show.
Phil Jackson's new memoir is called The Last Season, A Team in Search of Its Soul. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the Alzheimer's Association, encouraging Americans to learn about ways to reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease on the web at alz.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, an interview with the late animator and director Chuck Jones. He helped bring to life Porky Pig, Elmer Fudd, Daffy Duck, and Bugs Bunny, and was the sole creator of Pepe Le Pew, Roadrunner, and Wile E. Coyote. Volume 2 of the Looney Tunes Golden Collection is just out on DVD. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.